Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and The Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. But before we begin, do not forget you can catch the highlights from every Premier League game before anyone else simply by downloading The Times app to your smartphone. This week, it's fantastic because we don't have anybody down the line in remote locations out in the provinces, although we have not one but two northern presences here, and they are Rory Smith from Yorkshire, James Scowcroft from somewhere in the northwest. You're a United fan, right?
Suffolk.
One of many Cockney Reds, and the man true to himself who supports his local team where he grew up. Please tell me that's the case. You're from Essex, aren't you?
Too right I am.
There you go. It's Stuart Robson. First, we take a look at Stoke City and Manchester United.
Whelan, out to Cameron. He stands it up towards the far post. Knocked down by Walters. Arnautovic misses it. Charlie Adam doesn't. That's an absolute rocket straight up into the top right-hand corner. And Stoke are back ahead once again.
I'm going to throw this straight out to you, James, because I'm not outing you. Yes, you have a predilection for the guys in red. Our colleague, James Ducker, the mild-mannered James Ducker, wrote in today's paper that David Moyes said that United played very well against Stoke. And I thought he witheringly said he was bordered between the defiant and the delusional in saying that. A, do you agree with James? And B, if Moyes doesn't think that, can you tell us why he would say that?
Well, I think David Moyes needs to create a sense of positivity, doesn't he, around Old Trafford? It's so negative this season. You know, the arrival of Juan Mata gave a lift for two or three days, but even that seems to have popped. I saw this morning Manchester United have lost 8 out of 24 league games. That's 1 in 3, you know, which is a staggering record considering where Manchester United are in the English game. I didn't think they'd win the league this year, but I think, and I do think they'll finish outside the top four. I think to finish outside the top four is a massive failure on David Moyes' part, and I don't think he can hide behind that. I understand why he has to be positive. I thought they were a little bit unlucky against Stoke at the weekend. You know, if you look at the first goal, it's a bit unlucky, the deflection. Charlie Adams hits a wonderful strike, and United were lucky not to get an equaliser in, but it's clutching at straws every week. You know, it's too many defeats.
Is this Moyes the worst United manager you've seen since you were, say, 14 or 15 years old?
I've only seen one. You know, I just feel if you look at every manager, their personality, the team, is the manager's personality. If you go right the way through, if you look at Mourinho, his personality dictates how the team are. And I just think if you look at Moyes' personality, it's the way his side are playing as well.
It's a tricky line to pick, though, isn't it? Because managers, when results are going badly, will always try and be positive. They'll try and say, you know, we lost, but we didn't do that badly. We did this well, we did this well, we did this well. I remember Roy Hodgson at Liverpool, after they lost to Derby 2-0 to Everton, saying that it was the best he'd seen them play. And you could tell that he was trying to do that the same thing. He was trying to say, kind of, things aren't that bad, we're going in the right direction. And that's totally understandable.
But when you say that, do they say it for the benefit of public opinion or for the benefit of their own players?
Well, I suspect it's more the players and...
I think a bit of both.
Yeah, really. A little bit of both. But it's a difficult line to pitch because the fans can't be fooled. So what James writes quite rightly this morning is that the danger is if that's United playing well, then what do they look like when they play badly? And you can take it both ways. You can say, well, if that's what you think is good, then that's not good enough.
So far, the Manchester United support are very, very behind David Moyes. But if you speak to individual Manchester United fans, they're not. But collectively, they are. Now, there is going to be a tipping point. I don't think that tipping point will come this season, but I think next season, all of a sudden, it will be, you know, you have to deliver now. You have to produce something.
I don't think Manchester United are as bad as their position and their results have shown so far. But what they aren't particularly good at doing is closing the ball down. That's been the difference between last season and this season and previous seasons. They're not closing the ball down. There's not enough. And we talk about David Moyes being an organiser of teams and quite defensive. The defensive side of the game hasn't been good enough. To be a top side, you have to attack well, which they're not doing quite as well as they did last year. But you also need to be able to to stop the opposition playing. And it's too easy to play against Manchester United. We saw that with Sunderland in the Carling Cup. It was too easy for Sunderland to pass the ball around. It was too easy at times for Stoke to pass the ball. And we're talking about Stoke here.
But is that not, in a sense, the most worrying thing, that the one thing you expected from Moyes, like, I think we all probably maybe didn't think he'd provide sort of scintillating attacking football. We weren't expecting Pep Guardiola. But the thing you expect is organisation, discipline and hard work. And that's what United aren't doing.
I'm curious, though, in this theme of what he said about performance. And I mean, we can debate whether they did play very well or not very well. Because you could also make the point that if they don't lose Evans and Jones and Charlie Adam, you know, he scores two goals, but one of them is deflected, the other one is a wonder strike. And he's done them before, but it's still a wonder strike. If they go, they win this game, then everything's fine and dandy, right? We've seen this before.
But there's too much left to chance, isn't there? There's too much. For me, this year, Manchester United have been involved in too many good games where under Alex Ferguson, they weren't really good. They just killed the game out, 1-0, 2-0. You know, Stuart's absolutely spot on. Two sides of football. One's when you got the ball and one's when you haven't got the ball. And Manchester United under Ferguson were brilliant with both. You know, when they didn't have the ball, they were as good as any team. And when they had the ball, they've always had flair. And I just think they're far too open, like you say. And like you say, you defend to attack. So if your defending gets better, your attacking will get better as well.
When you play against the top teams, you know that you're not going to get too much of the ball because they close you down, they win it back quickly, you're going to struggle to create opportunities. At the moment, people can play against Manchester United. It's too open in midfield. People don't get tight enough to players. They're not sure whether they should drop off or squeeze up for offside. Whatever it is, there doesn't seem to be a cohesive unit defensively at the moment, and that allows the opposition to have the ball, and that means Manchester United have got to attack from deep areas at times.
A lot of people talk about Man United's midfield, and I don't think the back four is strong enough. I think if you look at Vidic and Ferdinand in the prime, they were so comfortable on the ball. They could come out with the ball and that would just push everybody forward. It would push Carrick on. And I think they really struggled at the back, just ball playing centre halves.
What I thought was interesting, though, is he's chasing the game and he does the kind of thing that a lot of managers do. He just kind of puts on more attacking players. And, you know, at one point you had Welbeck, Van Persie, Mata, Rooney and Young all on the pitch on the same time. And there's a part of me that says, I understand why you're doing it, you're chasing the game. There's a part of me that also says, you're better than Stoke. If you keep playing your way, and you have to believe you're better than Stoke, you don't need to mess with your formation. Just stick with, you know, you can make a personnel change. But
well, there's two ways that you look at it. If you just stick with it and you're losing the game and you stick with the personnel you've got and the shape of the team that you've got and you say, well, eventually it will come. If you don't win the game or don't get back into the game, people say, why didn't you change it? Yeah, things weren't going. Why didn't you sort it out? Why didn't you change it? The manager didn't do anything. So I can understand why he did, but I absolutely agree with you. Sometimes when you start throwing on players, attacking players, left, right, you lose the shape of the team and suddenly there's no fluency, they're not quite sure where the next pass is and you don't get the result you're looking for. So I think you're absolutely right. When he sent on all these players, they lost their shape. So they were playing off the cuff. And once you start playing off the cuff, we're going back to James saying, you're playing with a bit of luck then, or trying to play with a bit of luck then.
I don't have an issue so much if you're a manager who does that regularly, if your team that's used to doing that. I mean, obviously, Mourinho's done that in the past. A bunch of players have, or managers have. But it just seems rather un-Moyes-like.
It's the randomness, isn't it? It's the we need goals. Let's throw on more strikers.
But that's not something
sometimes
Moyes does.
It creates more confusion. You just end up getting in each other's way. Mm. You know,
is that a concern though? Because
I think it's a.
It's something he's done
several times this season. You know, he's changed it around. I think it was a Tottenham game when they lost 2-1 at home, where he just changed it and it just went total attack. And they hardly looked like scoring. I think Valencia went to right back to be an attacking right. He just tried to get as many forward players on as he can, which you can understand. But I just think sometimes all of a sudden people don't know what they're doing.
There's still got to be a shape to it. Even when you're making changes, this is the shape we're going to play with. This is the style we want to play. You're going to do this job for the team. You've been sent. I think at times he sent players on just for the sake of sending players on.
There has to be a plan, doesn't there? You have to have a clue a way of breaking down the opposition, regardless of the players.
And that's where you mentioned Mourinho. What Mourinho does, he decides, maybe after half an hour, what we're doing isn't working. The way the opposition is set up, we're not going to break them down. So I'm going to make a change to do this. But it's a set plan. It's not again just random, or we're going to put on more attacking players. But I think, he's got a set plan.
I think Gary Neville said to it, he said, under Ferguson, we never ever panicked. Even up until that 85th minute, we always knew we'd get a chance. And I think
they were going to play 115 minutes.
They didn't know that was coming.
But I always think that a manager who throws on loads of strikers, in general, not just with Moyes, I always find that always looks to me like a mark of desperation. It's I don't know how to win this game. Mm. Let's effectively take it. Almost that the manager is deciding that chance, the 50% sort of chance ratio is a better bet than the plan that he's got. Well, and that's not a great sign.
I mean, I was at another game, West Ham, Swansea, and just going to keep it on the same point. Swansea were 2-0 down and they sent on loads of attacking players, but they lost all fluency. They were never going to score. They could still be playing today. They wouldn't have scored because nobody really knew where they were playing. Pozuelo was running here, there and everywhere. It just didn't work for them. So it's not just David Moyes. It's lots of managers that do it.
To be fair to Moyes, he did have to burn two substitutions early on Jones and Evans. And so at that point, maybe, you know, his options were somewhat limited. You're talking about maybe should he have sent off Januzaj, perhaps. He had no other. I think Darren Fletcher was the only sort of non-attacking player left on the bench. I want to talk about Stoke for a minute, because it seems to me that so few people had any belief in Mark Hughes when the season began. You know, they spent very little money relative to before when Pulis was there, and they had one of the highest net spends in the Premier League. Actually, a funny digression here, since we're on the subject of United, and it is marginally related to Stoke. I saw some tweets where they were complaining that their investment in the last 5 years has been equal to Stoke's in terms of net spend, and it's a disgrace, blah, blah, blah. The end point now is that Stoke's investment was the third highest in the Premier League after Chelsea and Manchester City. Do you, as a United fan, do you think that the club have some kind of obligation to go and spend a lot of money simply because you have more money than everybody else? Or would you rather see your team win with the same resources as everybody else?
Well, what you're seeing is that the lack of investment by the Glazers, you're now seeing the product of it.
Look at But lack of investment, the fans of every club in England, except for Chelsea and City, could say, well, we've had less investors than you've had with the Glazers.
But it's not as much as the Glazers could have invested if they'd not taken 400 million quid out of the club to pay off their own loans. So, yeah, no, I take your point completely. That you're not, I saw a tweet from a United fan saying that they can't compete with Chelsea and City because they don't have as much money as them, which is, I suppose, theoretically true.
Well, but their owners don't have as much money as the owners.
In a real sense, they have just as much money as Chelsea and City because they
produce. But then, to be fair, the minority owner of QPR could go and buy Abramovich and Mansour and put them in a cage if he wanted to.
In a way, it's surprising that he hasn't.
But the Glazers have taken 400 million out of rent. Well, they've taken a lot more than that out of the club. If that's, it's just money that's gone.
Yeah.
And if that money is reinvested in the team, we wouldn't be talking about Manchester United losing to Stoke here now. It would be, you know, City United in the title race.
Well, I was going to drive to, and I read about this at some point, just because obviously in Spain there's a three-horse race. People said, it's a two-horse league,
One-horse race in Spain now.
Exactly. If Mansour and Abramovich had never come to the Premier League, if it had been difficult for foreign investors to come in and buy, right, because they point out, well, except for Valencia's two titles and Depor, right, in the last 20 years, only Barcelona and Real Madrid, I think, have shared 17 of 20 titles, right? What would it have been like in the Premier League if those two people hadn't come in?
It would have been Manchester United winning the league every year, except for the times when Arsenal clicked, basically.
Yeah, and basically the times Arsenal won would have been United throwing it away.
To some extent.
Yeah, and if on top of that United had decided to go and negotiate their TV rights contract individually, then it would have been United winning every single game. It would have been United C team.
If there were no foreign investors in the Premier League, then England would be Germany.
And United would be Bayern Munich. Would you prefer that?
You're making a point about the spending. You know, Manchester United never gets the credit it deserves for the young talent they've produced. Manchester United have had a youth team player in their squad since 1930, whatever, I think, for the last 70 years. You know, you talk about the money and this, that and the other. Manchester United, their youth system and the policy that they've, especially under Sir Alex, never really get. You know, if you look at England.
But they made a whole movie about the class of 92 or whatever it was.
You know, Man City going to have the class of 2014?
You don't think so?
To be fair to City, their youth teams are apparently staggeringly good. They've not lost.
Oh, they're fantastic.
But most of them now
are foreign, yeah.
Are foreign, and they buy players in at 14 and 15 off other clubs.
Whereas Darren Fletcher's from Manchester. David Beckham's from Manchester.
Yanazai,
there's another one, yeah.
Captain, Belgium-born crossover.
These lads going to get a chance at Man City.
The problem that Mark Hughes has got is that for all the talk of revolution, he still has a Tony Pulis team, and when things are difficult for Stoke, they automatically revert to the things they've been taught.
And
for
if
the last
he hadn't
years.
Have beaten Manchester United on Saturday, they would have been in the relegation or near the relegation era. They haven't done particularly well under Mark Hughes. He's tried to change their style of football to a certain degree. He tried to bring in Odin Wingie, didn't he, to add more pace to the side.
They've got Odin Wingie.
They have. So they brought him into more pace, but they're still playing one-dimensional at times, and when they do pass the ball, they don't do it with any penetration. They pass for the sake of passing. And I saw them against Chelsea in the FA Cup, and I've seen them on several other occasions, and I think they still look a poor side. And I don't know what Mark Hughes is trying to get from the team. If he wants to play and be penetrative with your passing. If he wants to go long ball and be penetrative with that. But at the moment, he's caught in between the two.
Well, what is a fair expectation, though, in terms of how long it takes to go and change a team to make your mark on the team? I mean, in some ways, if it might
Six
be a stretch
weeks.
To sort of compare... What?
6 weeks.
Oh, well, then Moyes is
you have
in trouble
to play to
then,
your
right?
strengths. That's...
Do you?
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Do you bring in... Do you play to your strengths, or do you bring in the manager because you want him to play a certain philosophy? My understanding, I think we all agree with this, is Mark Hughes was brought in with the quote-unquote promise to play a certain brand of football, right?
Well, I'm not sure why they brought Mark Hughes in to play a certain brand of football, because at Blackburn, when he took over there...
That was a million years ago.
Yeah, and at Manchester City, they didn't play particularly good
Fulham,
football.
Fulham, they played good football.
Not really.
No, they played okay. They played okay football. They didn't play attractive, entertaining football. Well, Mark Hughes is still quite...
He was at the same game as me on Saturday, West Ham, Swansea. Mm. Now, Swansea got a fantastic reputation, rightly so, and I'm not going to knock anything down. Mm. They try to... I think the second goal, the corner kick, they try and play out from the back. Mm. Would you say watching Swansea at the weekend was entertaining?
No, it wasn't. They didn't play particularly well. They didn't play at high enough tempo when they had the ball. Then they had chance to counter-attack. They didn't do it with enough pace. I thought Swansea were really disappointing. And they couldn't match the physicality of Andy Carroll and Nolan making forward runs.
But Swansea are playing particularly badly at the moment, whereas Stoke... kind of play well and they play badly and you can't really tell the difference.
Well, because what's a fair expectation of Mark Hughes? I mean, if you were coach, Rory, and you come in and you say, like, we don't really have much money here, you can have Eric Peters and, you know, and just about it. And
he's the man you want when you want to change your style.
What's that?
Getting a sort of journeyman Dutch left back, he'll help change his style.
He's more and more caps for Holland than you do. But...
through an accident of birth.
What is a fair expectation? What's a fair
for
goal?
This season?
Stay up and transition the style?
Yeah, I think that was the plan. Right. But I would imagine it would stay up with rather more comfort than they're going to.
When you look at a club, you're looking for, and the way the team plays, you're looking for some identity. What does that club represent? What is that manager trying to do? I'm not sure what Mark Hughes is trying to do at Stoke.
Newcastle blown themselves out here. And Arthur has lost it. And now Barini. That's Cole back to his left-hand side. Here is Cole back! 3-0 to Sunderland! What a day for Gus Poyet and his team!
All right, I feel uncomfortable talking about the Tyneside Derby without the legendary George Colkin in the studio. Gus Poyet, I think he'd be 8th or 9th if the Premier League started when he was appointed. And it's funny because everybody talked about how rubbish their summer transfer policy was and everything. And, you know, in the end, they broke even. They cut the wage bill by 30%. Does this mean that if you buy the argument that it was rubbish, does it mean that Poyet's some kind of genius? Does it mean that he's had a very easy run? What does it mean, Stuart?
No, I don't think he's hasn't had an easy run. What he's given is the players more confidence. He's now got a style of play. It didn't work for him early on because they got caught out on the ball, but they're trying to pass it through midfield. He's making the best of some of the players he's got. Colback looks an exceptional player now. Bridcut's come in, and he's going to play instead of
He's a player Chelsea produced who's playing in the Premier League. So
not for Chelsea.
See, Catamol, I never understood Catamol because I don't think he's a particularly good passer. and he's an aggressive player, but he can't run, Katamol. So when people run off the back of him, that was always a problem for Sunderland and Wigan when he was playing for them. Now Bridcut is a little bit quicker and he'll do the same job and he's a better passer than Katamol. Well, and Colback is an excellent player.
He seems like a totally different player to Katamol because...
So he wants his holding midfield player to be a totally different player. He wants him to be
a passer rather than the ball.
He's a quarterback, really, yeah. Doesn't he? Sitting in front of the back post. He's a very good signing, I think.
For he's going to keep switching the play and playing it into the front players. He's going to do a different job.
Why didn't they sell Catamol then when they had the opportunity?
That's a good question. No one seems quite certain why it fell through. But it was Sunderland who pulled the plug.
Right. Hey, are you so down on Catamol? I mean, what you just said about he can't run. I mean...
That's why he commits so many fouls. He's aggressive, but he commits so many fouls because he's desperate when people start to run beyond him.
I think he's a big character at Sunderland, isn't he? He's a lad from the northeast, and I think maybe Poyet's looked at it and thinking, well, if I do get rid of him, I'm taking a big character out of the dressing room here. You know, maybe in the summer it might happen. I don't know.
Said he was a bad character in the dressing room.
Probably because he was a good character and he was getting everybody on side.
Probably because I don't think people's opinions of Catamol within the club has changed much since the previous manager. What's the deal with Newcastle? I don't understand this. They seem to be on a good run. They seem to have a lot of success buying players in France. They sell Kabay. They knew they were going to sell Kabay. They knew they were going to get a big chunk of change in. Why were they unable to...
I can answer that question.
Thank you.
Even though George isn't here. They think they can replace Kabay. They think they can repeat the trick.
With Marvaux.
Not with Mother. Yeah. They think they can go back to France and just because they've done it once, they got to buy from Lille for $5.5 million.
So who do they think
they can go and get another one?
Who do they think they can get?
They looked at Grenier, but he's not the same sort of player, really. He's more kind of fancy Dan, is Grenier. Who else is there? A holding midfielder in France or a ball playing holding midfielder in France? I don't know who the actual target is.
Because by the time Kabay left, he changed his position. He was playing more behind the front striker, when he first went, he was playing that much deeper.
He kind of went back to... Cause earlier in his career, of course, he played behind the striker as well. So, I mean, he's just a very versatile player.
Why didn't one of the big clubs in this country come in for Kabay?
Surprised United didn't.
Yeah.
They've certainly been watching him. Arsenal obviously wanted him in the summer. So I don't
to be fair, Arsenal offered £8 million, I think, and they said that it was a derisory bid, which it probably was. But by the same token, he went for, what, £19 million? It's a lot of money for a guy who's that age. You know, we're not talking about a 22-year-old. He's, what, 26, 27?
He's 26, yeah.
He's in his prime.
In his prime, yeah. I think he's a great signing for PSG. He's a brilliant signing.
I think he'd be a great signing for Manchester United. I think he's that kind of midfield player.
At the same time, although there is always a tendency to say, you know, to place the question mark if a big Premier League club doesn't come in for him, I think most we'll start seeing more and more that a lot of players, particularly Francophone players, would rather play for PSG than Premier League clubs because, A, it's in Paris, where you know, the language element, and also they will be in the Champions League every single year. So that they are an attractive proposition.
You've highlighted one problem with Newcastle. I always think their biggest problem, if you go into a game with Williamson and Taylor as your two centre-halves, in any Premier League game, I think you've got problems. You know, I've watched Taylor many, many times over the Stephen Taylor. I don't think he can read situations. He's aggressive, yes, but commits too many fouls. He doesn't read situations.
He's big.
He doesn't win enough balls in the air. He's late when players make runs across him. Right, I can analyse goal after goal after goal and say Stephen Taylor isn't good enough. And I would say the same with Williamson.
To be fair, though, presumably Coloccini's the first choice centre half.
But he hasn't been. Coloccini's been sub on many occasions this year. But even when he's been fit, he's been injured. And when he should be, he's the best one of their centre halves, but he hasn't played enough.
To speak for George, who can't be with us,
yeah.
George says that Williamson's been really good this season. I've not seen enough of Newcastle to comment, but George is of the view that Williamson's done
well. He'll win balls in the air. He'll attack the ball. But when there's clever movement and things happening around him, he can't see it.
You talked about owners here, so let's bring it back to United. Would you rather have Ashley or the Glazers?
I'd rather have Kermit the Frog than the Glazers.
So you would rather have Ashley, right?
I don't know. I don't really know enough about Mike Ashley, so I'm not going to comment on that. I just think... unless you're a Chelsea fan or a Man City fan, for obvious reasons, you know, this is something that's, you know, look at Leeds United last week, you know, this needs to be sorted out, really. Who can come in and buy clubs and own clubs? And, you know, football clubs are big institutions. People shouldn't just be able to walk in and
do this, that, and the other. Do you believe a football club then is a public trust as much as it is a business?
Yeah, I do.
I do as well, although...
That's a surprise.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think the problem is that with Ashley, there's no reason that Mike Ashley shouldn't own a football club. He's not that your nationality should be a factor, but he's English, so we don't object to him because he's one of these.
But he's an outsider.
One of these terrible foreigners.
Cockney, though.
He's a Cockney.
I remember thinking that people came onto the pitch and
do you think the 51 rule would work in England, and the English game would be better for it?
I think Manchester United would be much better for it. I think
obviously Chelsea and Man City wouldn't be better for it.
No,
would Arsenal be better for it?
No, they wouldn't. They might be slightly better off than they are now, but United would be so much better off than everybody else.
The problem with the 50+1 rule is that the teams that want it to be introduced are the teams with bad owners. The teams with good owners will always just say no.
The TV money is there because it's a high-end product.
The money that's been invested.
Because of the players that are there, right? Yeah, a lot of it is the branding and the packaging. The Premier League has done a fantastic job of that. But it's one thing to package Sergio Aguero. It's another thing to package Sean Goder, right? I mean, they're two different things. So I think there would be a fear on the part of many people to go to the 50+1 because you would end up... I mean, the Bundesliga, we all love the Bundesliga, right? The Bundesliga make about $150 million from overseas right. Do you know how much the Premier League makes?
A lot more than that.
Yeah. They make six
times. Whose eyes are you looking through this? You know, if you're going to ask the match day fan now that goes home and away supporting his club in the Premier League, it's almost impossible to do. It is so expensive, it's almost impossible to support your team.
But at the same time, those fans, like every other fan, is addicted to this circus of transfer deadline day and glamorous foreign stars and all of that stuff. All that stuff that we associate with the Premier League, we all buzz off it. And that if you take away the foreign owners, if you bring in 50+1, you don't have the debate about whether Manchester United should have invested £400 million in their squad. That wouldn't be an option.
But are we going to miss a generation of fans here? Because the 17, 18-year-old who years ago used to get on the local bus, go and support his team, can he now go to watch Arsenal home?
I think
the reality is
you're going to get a different fan, right?
You know, yeah.
So people who aren't United fans may not know this about James, but he's that rare ex-pro who actually paid to go watch football matches, right? And you occasionally still do, right?
Quite often.
Exactly. Which I think, I'm not saying everybody has to be like that, but I think it means your view is closer to that than I think a lot of people can relate to when it comes to these issues. You know, back then, right, think about what it was like when you were 15 years old, right? You had no social media. You had no internet, I assume, in your home, right? You probably had a crappy radio station in Sussex who probably played...
Suffolk. It's the end of the world, Suffolk, by the way.
Right.
Centre of the universe.
Right. I don't even know what's your local team in Suffolk?
Gab, come on. Ipswich.
Don't you know where Suffolk is?
I can't believe you've asked me that question.
All right, okay. So, yeah, all right. So, you're right. So Ipswich. I'm sorry. It's outside the M25. I apologize, right? So, you probably got Ipswich games on the radio, right? You probably had to strain to listen to get any kind of Manchester United news. You probably watched CFAX waiting for the number to turn, right, to see if Clayton Blackmore had scored, right? This was your world. And then when you were lucky, you used to be able to go to Old Trafford because you had an uncle or somebody, right, who took you. And even if you lived in Manchester, it would be the same thing because you would only get to see them once every other week in person plus crappy highlights on television. And yet you probably lived your fandom. You probably thought about the club as much as people do today. Except today there are so many more fans who maybe might go to a game once a year, maybe once a lifetime, and they watch it on television and they interact in these other ways. And in the eyes of football clubs, those people are just as much fans as the guys with season tickets or the guys who take the bus.
Yeah.
And they can make, but more importantly, they can make money off those guys the same way they can make money off the guys who take the bus to Old Trafford.
So I take my son to Chelsea Manchester United, was it 2 weeks ago now? Two match tickets. By the time we get the train there and back, probably spent £250.
Yeah, there's no question that football's demographic is changing.
And with the money that's in the game now.
Yeah.
So it becomes a treat.
You know, the Premier League have taken £2 or £3 off an away ticket this year because they want to see stadiums full.
Well, I go even further than that. You know those little patches that say Premier League that you can get when you buy a shirt? You know how much those things cost? They're like £10. But that's the thing. That's what we're headed towards, right? We're headed towards, I think, in their model, in the model of these people, they want something where instead of going every week, right, instead of one James Scowcroft family unit going every week to watch Manchester United home and away, right, I'm going to have 60 James Scowcroft family units who are each going to go to one game, right? And so in the aggregate, there's going to be many more fans out there and they're going to make more money.
Lack of atmosphere in stadiums now.
I think you may well be right.
But I don't think the clubs care about that because it's not like you pay more if it's noisy. You are right that we are risking losing a generation of fans. Of course we are, but we're also...
I think you've already lost them. You know, you won't know the impact until 20 years.
But the fans are still there. But then bear in mind, we live in a world where we're also losing an entire generation of young people in terms of employment, in terms of housing. So, you know, this is the point that we've started, and this sounds really stupid to talk about on a football podcast, but we've basically said, we're the first generation ever to say, do you know what, as long as we're all right, sod the future. And it's the same in football.
Gab, the big problem is, you're talking about marketing the Premier League, this, that and the other. You can't do it if it's a half-empty stadium.
I think that's true, actually. I think that's really important to the...
Okay, well, I'll go with you on this one. I do a lot of Italian football. I still think tactically the Italian football is the best in Europe, but it doesn't look It doesn't look so good on TV because there's empty stadiums.
Exactly. You know, I'm not saying you have to do this, you have to do that, but I think you have to get the balance right.
Is there not another...
Guys, do we want to debate the transfer window, or do you just want to continue talking about this? Because I had read the transfer window. Because I think this is more interesting.
I was going to say that the problem with 50 plus one, apart from the fact that the only clubs who want it are the ones who aren't doing that well. So I would have thought that while things were flying for Manchester United, 50 plus one was something that some fans, obviously the Green and Gold and Duncan Drastow, they thought about 50 plus one. The vast majority couldn't ever fly in anything about 50 plus one because they're winning. The other problem is that it you cannot introduce it. Just how on earth are a group of fans going to get the money together to buy out the vulture capitalists and the oligarchs and the billionaires who already own the clubs? It's just not feasible.
The government has to step in, don't they? And they have to...
But then they get chucked out of FIFA, don't they, if the government starts interfering in football?
Right, but you don't even need... Well, first of all, the league could reform itself. I mean, there are ways to do it politically if there's an appetite to do so. But the point you made, I mean, I'm sorry, but you must have seen this tweet a million times. If every United fan chucked in £5, they could buy the Glazers out, right? Mm-hmm. Remember they attempted to do that at Liverpool. You had the Red Knights and all this stuff, right? I mean, it didn't come to pass. Also, because the Glazers are kind of tough as nails and they believe in what they do. But the potential was there, right? I mean, there are other ways if we want better governance. And I refer people to Duncan Drastow. If you don't know who he is and you happen to be a Manchester United fan, you may be interested in finding more about it. He's involved with the Manchester United Supporters Trust. There are supporters trusts at, I think, every Premier League and Football League club. At some of them, they actually own shares and have a say. Obviously, they're in this because they believe that You know, they believe in good governance. They believe in oversight of the club. At other clubs like Swansea, who you guys were all making fun of their lack of ideas and how bad they were, but you know, they sit on the board.
On the other hand, there's no more pleasant place to go than Swansea.
Swansea,
hospitality you get, then you go fantastic. In there. The way they treat you, it's still a very, very good football club, Swansea, and they know how to host the football game at the moment.
And that model is perfectly possible, but only as it stands, unless there is some sort of change in the way that the league governs itself, is only possible in cases like Swansea, where people can get hold of a portion of the club as fans and guide its direction from the bottom up. It's very difficult to do it with Manchester United. But the debate's meant to be about the transfer window, and that ties in, because the transfer window is the great symbol of what football has become, where fans get more... there is a section of fans who seem to be more bothered about it. Who their club are signing than what their club are doing on the pitch. There's this constant demand for owners to spend money, which is incredibly unhealthy, that the solution for everyone in football is spend more money. You get cases like United where they need to spend money, but you get Arsenal fans on the transfer deadline day in August, they're delighted that Wenger signed Mesut Ozil. He then doesn't go and sign Julian Draxler, a player they don't need, not long term at the moment, wonderful footballer though he is, and signs Kim Chalstrom, and Arsenal fans kick off because they've not spent enough money. That there is an element where the fans have to take a degree of responsibility. If you want better governance, if you want a more sustainable model, you have to stop with this endless consumption.
With Arsenal, I think the Arsenal fans are looking at the moment, and I fully agree with it. This is their best ever chance to win the title. Now, they've got the transfer window that they could have strengthened the squad.
Yep.
And they've got a chance, if Giroud got injured, if one or two of the other players got injured, this is your best ever chance to win trophies. They haven't won trophies for 8-9 years. Suddenly they buy get a player on loan that's injured.
Yes, that is a different case.
So Arsenal's a different case to many others.
But then the two Germans that Arsenal were linked with this window were Draxler, 20, 30, 37 million quid. Wonderful talent, left winger, not a striker.
Don't need him.
He's not what they need. Miroslav Klose, 104. Mm. Striker, vastly experienced, would have been potentially a loan or a nominal fee. Klose is the player they needed much more. Klose would have been the perfect signing for Arsenal. Lazio maybe wouldn't have wanted to sell him. That would not have satisfied Arsenal. A lot of Arsenal fans, just what Arsenal fans, like all fans, want to see is these ridiculous sums of money permanently being pumped into their team.
Is that because everyone's been brainwashed?
Brainwashed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
And I would say when you look at when fans will say we want Draxler, I wonder how many fans have actually seen Draxler
exactly
play.
Right.
You know, they might have seen him once on the telly, or seen the highlights of him. They've no any idea what he's like.
Do you not think transfer deadline day now is almost replaced the old FA Cup final day?
Yeah,
how it was in there. It's almost exciting that people, we've got 20 minutes left, who's going to do this?
You see Jim White getting a haircut, you used to see players getting a haircut on cup final
what
day.
What I don't get about that is, it's not like people are actually doing business at like the training grounds or at the football clubs. Why do they make poor James Cooper stand outside Old Trafford in those miserable conditions for hours when all he's doing, because he's not there reporting, right? He's just basically there on the phone with, I'm assuming, United's press officers who are so forthcoming anyway, right?
So I'll ask you, do you watch it?
What?
On transfer deadline, do you watch it all day long?
Okay, I have Sky Sports News because, unfortunately, because it's my only option and I like the ticker at the bottom, I have it all the time.
Some of these transfers that they make, they haven't really studied what they're going to do. Where is the scouting system that used to be in place? Where is the list of players
I'll say this about Draxler, right?
I'm talking about the whole scouting system.
But you have to assume that, to some degree that that's there, and that's why, I mean, I was having this conversation with somebody. Because there's no culture of directors of football to actually go and conclude deals, and here you could bring Conor Pianca into it. I mean, Ian Ayre may have a lot of failings, but I don't know that this was entirely his fault, to be honest. Because you don't have that. You don't have a generation of it, right? So who becomes a director of football in this country, right? Either a foreigner, which of course is bad, or an ex-player
who was an ex-manager. Of football is? It depends whether it used to be called a chief scout.
Or an agent. No. I think it's different. I think in terms of best practice, a director of football, A, should appoint the manager. He shouldn't be brought in after the manager's there.
Yep.
Should appoint a manager who fits the director's of football's view of the club, right? Yep. So the two have to come together. He should oversee the chief scouts. He should know he should be very good at negotiating, both negotiating player contracts and knowing exactly who the agents are so you don't get taken for a ride and the way these people operate. Now, I mean, people may have different things, right? In Liverpool, they report that the Konoplyanka deal failed because they hit a release clause and the guy simply refused to honor the release clause, right? Now, let's assume that's true, even though people in Ukraine say the opposite. I don't know. I haven't seen Konoplyanka's contract. Even if he has a release clause in his contract, if you go there and he's not willing to offer to honor the release clause, first of all, it's not like in Spain where legally you show up with a wad of money and it's your release clause and you become a free agent, right? It would have meant that Konoplyanka would have had to sue Dnipro under the Ukrainian legal system, which as you, if you watch the news, you might know it's a bit, you know, they've got bigger fish to fry there right now. He probably would have been banned for a period of time because he would have had to go outside the system. He couldn't play for a year or so, right? That's the only way that if the club don't want to sell, he could have enforced his release clause. So somebody a bit savvier would have probably gone out there knowing I have this deal on the bag, and he would have been prepared for the club to basically say, oh, wait, sorry, did I say 15 million on the phone? Oh, how funny. I meant 17 million. You've come all this way. You've brought your friend, the Dr. Zaff, the club doctor here. Surely you're not going to want to go home empty-handed. Fork over another 2 million. What is it to you? And at that point, Ian Ayre and the people behind him have to be strong and say, we like Konoplyanka at this price. We don't like him at that price. You know, and make a decision, and then we can debate whether it's the right decision or not. But I think in this case, the system worked to some degree, unless they really thought that he had a release clause.
The problem with Konoplyanka and Liverpool is not the failure is not signing, not the failure is not failing to sign Konoplyanka. The failure is getting into a position where not signing Konoplyanka looks like failure. Everyone knows it's difficult to negotiate with billionaires and oligarchs. Everyone knows that. Ukrainian Russian clubs, the same rules don't apply. The owners don't have to subscribe to this logic where, oh, his contract's running out in 18 months. I better sell to protect my value. If you're the second richest man in Ukraine, you don't care about that. That's not a problem. Ian Ayre went out there with 3 or 4 days in the transfer window to go. That is the mistake. The Liverpool, A, were in the position where they hadn't signed anybody with 3 or 4 days of the transfer window to go. There's a failure in going out there not knowing if you can get the deal done because you've applied the wrong logic to the way that the opposite side's going to negotiate. And there's also the failure that they were prepared to pay more money for Konoplyanka, their backup signing, than they were for Mohamed Salah, their first choice, which makes no sense.
Going back to your timing, if you've got a scouting system and a director of football that's got a list of targets, why when the transfer window opens that they then try and look to buy the players and get the players in there. And then they've got a month.
Well, that's best practice, right? Best practice is
never
you do this business.
But it's a circle, isn't it? A moves for B to be freed up for C and D. Do you not think that happens to a lot of clubs, though, that they miss targets? It's just foolish for it to be out in the public domain and people know. You know, Manchester United were a classic example last summer with the Atletico Bilbao here, or was it?
I'm sure
clubs miss out on players all the time, but just keep it quiet. Don't say, we're going to sign him because you're setting yourself up for it.
That's right, but then I have a slightly different view on that as a journalist, which is that it's not that the clubs kind of go out in public and say that they want to sign a player. It's that journalists are doing their jobs and finding out the name.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily the club's fault that the name becomes public.
So having swallowed up the transfer debate, let's do some quick hits. So Romelu Lukaku's injured. Lasina Traore is not ready. Nikica Jelovic has been sold. But it's no problem at all as Kevin Morales fires Everton past Aston Villa. James, are you surprised he transitioned so easily to the centre forward role?
A little bit, yeah. I think so. I think he's a very good player, Morales. I think he's very direct. I can see how he can do it because he's one of these players that wants to shoot, wants to score a goal, really. So I think if you've got that mentality in you, it shouldn't be too much of a problem.
Imagine being that good and only being like the 30th best Belgian in the universe. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain makes his first start since opening day and steals the show with the two goals that sink Pulis's Palace. Stuart, should Wenger find a way to shoehorn him into the lineup every week?
When he's on form, yes, because he's an outstanding player, and he can play in several different positions. He played in central midfield yesterday. He can play right wing, he can play left wing. He can even play as the second centre forward. When he's on form and playing with confidence and fully fit, he should be in the team every week, and I think he's going to play from now to the end of the season quite a lot.
Every week, wow, high praise for a kid that's still only just 20 years old. Liverpool are held at West Brom as Kolo Touré has an afternoon to forget. Rory, you were there, I believe. Was this a game Liverpool should have won, or did they get their just desserts?
It was a game Liverpool should have won before it started. It was a game that deserved to end in a draw. after it started. Liverpool were really poor. That's as bad as I've seen Liverpool this season. I think the pitch at West Brom doesn't help. Both Martinez and Rodgers now have said that it's not conducive to passing football, but they just looked devoid of rhythm. They looked a little bit kind of lacking in appetite. They didn't get going at all. The strike force, Sturridge and Suarez were... It was just one of those afternoons where their touch wasn't true, the balls didn't fall for them. It was a bad afternoon for everyone, as well as Kolo Touré, obviously, although it was his mistake that will that attracted the headlines. They need to pick themselves up for that because they've got a much tougher game against Arsenal next week.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Cardiff get a huge 3 points against Norwich and substitutes Wilfried Zaha and Kenwyn Jones steal the show. James, who will have a bigger impact on whether Vincent Tan gets a stay in the Premier League?
Wilfried Zaha, a big, big talent. I saw a lot of him in his Crystal Palace days. Baffled why David Moyes didn't really give him a go at Manchester United, considering their current problems this season. But I think he's a real talented player, and I think Solskjaer's that kind of manager that will get the best out of him. And I think
Kenwyn Jones, the Aldi Adebayor, is a brilliant signing for Cardiff.
Okay, Rory thinks Kenwyn Jones is a brilliant signing for Cardiff.
No, this is just what they need.
Kenwyn Jones is a good signing, but I'm really interested to see how well Wilfried Zaha does. I think he's a very good player.
Paulinho comes back to help Spurs to a 1-1 draw at Hull. Stuart, what do you make of Tim Sherwood's 4-4-2? Is it viable in this day and age when you don't have Yaya Toure and Fernandinho in the middle of the park?
If you play with two up front, you've got to make sure you're not outnumbered in midfield. So probably, I see Juventus a lot. I see a lot of Italian teams that play with three at the back. They can still play with three in midfield. They play with two wing-backs and they play with two up front. I think two up front still works well. You know, you can still link up with each other, but you must make sure either you play a diamond in midfield or you overload the midfield because you only play three at the back. At the moment, a 4-4-2 is a struggle.
Andy Carroll sets up two goals as West Ham sail past Swansea, but then Rory, one of your cheating ponytailed foreigner friends, gets him sent off. Should he appeal? And should we kind of be chastising Mr. Flores now? Because it's not the first time he's kind of done stuff like this.
No, but you know my sort of flexible morality on these things, and I think it's all part of the game. No question Carroll should appeal. That it wasn't a red card. To send him off for that is ridiculous. It was, funnily enough, I suspect it probably did hurt Chito Flores in the sense that he did catch him in the face, although on the forehead, not the part of the face he was grabbing. But
did he catch it? It looked to me like he caught the top of the knot of his ponytail.
I'm prepared to be wrong. It looked to me like his arm did catch his face, but there was no intent whatsoever, and it didn't hurt that much. Yes, Chito Flores has got form for this sort of thing, so he probably should be chastised.
He also jumped
by those
on Roy on Andy Carroll's face as well, which is what precipitated this whole thing.
Do you think that's a cultural thing in Spain? If you saw Cristiano Ronaldo last night when he got sent off, the sort of the play acting that goes on, it is almost seen as good practice in Spain.
Well, I think it's good practice. I don't have any more problem with that than with the fact that I was at the Hawthorns yesterday and saw loads of players appeal for throw-ins they knew that came off them. That irritates me as much as any other form of cheating. I don't know if it's just foreigners that do it. I think English players are just as bad.
His hero is Franny Lee, remember?
Gab, one for you. Apparently you wrote about financial fair play today, but it was removed from the newspaper because it was so rude. Is there anything we should know since we can't read it in the paper or online?
Well, I'll let you in on this since you can't read the column I wrote. It's basically April is when financial fair play were really coming to focus. And I think there were two important noteworthy developments, although not noteworthy enough to get in the paper, evidently. One was that rather than having... So they have an investigative panel and they have a panel that adjudicates. Now the investigative panel will be able to cut a deal with a football club rather than basically going through the whole judiciary process. It's a little bit like when Stuart's speeding and the traffic officer says, hey, you want to pay an on-the-spot fine, Stuart, or do you want to come see me in court? The problem is, though, is that other clubs can then appeal against that settlement, which creates a whole new dynamic. The other interesting point is that they changed the wording for one of the punishments, which basically effectively turns it into a salary cap. Let's say you're £10 million over the... your financial fair play break-even requirement, from your Champions League match day squad, you can't nominate players who make a combined £10 million. But I think that creates a whole other dynamic. And the fact that they went through the trouble of putting this in there at the last executive committee meeting suggests to me that this is the way they're going to go for their punishment. All right, boy, wasn't that interesting, talking financial fair play. My thanks to James Scowcroft, Stuart Robson, and, of course, Rory K. Smith. A quick reminder that we're going to be back on the road this week. See you in Manchester on the 6th of February at the Football Museum. Tickets cost £5 for Times Plus members and £7.50 for non-members. To book, visit www.ctickets.com/thetimes, or you can also call 0871-620-4025. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.